This programme was made with the support of the Broadcasting Authority of Ireland.
The River Blackwater flows through counties Kerry, Cork and Waterford. It rises near Slieve Lucra, or Mountain of Rushes, in Kerry, and runs east through Mallow and Fermoy in Cork. The river enters Waterford and flows through Lismore, before abruptly turning south at Cappoquin, finally meeting the sea at Yall Harbour. In this, the second part of Blackwater, Life and Lodgings, the fishing vessel Maeve and her three-man crew leave the small quay in Ardsalla, head for Temple Michael Castle, and onwards to Molana Abbey, before dropping anchor once more at the beautiful Ballinatrae House built by Grice Smith in 1795. We now enter an area of truly magnificent scenery.
After a Rhine crew, the river really is, the scenery is just stunning. You have trees of oak, beech and sycamore. They come right down from a great height down, right down to the river edge. And if you keep a sharp eye out, you'll see those little white birds. They have a little bit of a ponytail behind them. They're called little egrets. And they're a recent arrival. They used to come as far as North Africa, or the south of France. But they just stayed, and to use a tired old cliche, they became, I won't say more Irish than the Irish themselves, but they seemed to get on quite well with their distant cousin, the herons, and they seemed to have the river carved up between them for fishing purposes. And they're really thriving here.
Temple Michael Castle was a stronghold of the Earls of Desmond for over 200 years, dating back to the 14th century. The castle has lain in ruins since 1649, after the last Fitzgerald of Desmond successfully defended it against Lord Castlehaven in 1645. He would eventually be ousted by Cromwell 4 years later.
It was very well defended, and as well because of its position over the river, it was very, very difficult to get in here. But then Cromwell arrived, and he brought cannon guns with him. And when he came, cannons were fairly new at the time. It was about 4 years later, in 1649, and he knocked down two sides of the castle. And then the Fitzgerald that was here was a man called Garrod Crogach. He was known as Garrod the Strong. And he actually wasn't killed. He escaped across the water. And the castle then was plundered, and it was left completely as a ruin in 1649, and it has more or less remained as a ruin ever since. Garrod was not, as I said, actually killed, and he went and lived across the river at the other side, and he lived for a long number of years. And then when he died, he was buried at Ardmore, and there's stories told about him that he was always longing to come back. And it's sort of a haunting story about people saying that they used to hear him calling from the castle here at night, long after he died, for to be brought back. And the people could understand it was in Gaelic, and it was Garrod a Harringt, and that was give him a ferry, in other words, to bring him back. And this went on for years and years, and several people were supposed to have heard him calling. But eventually, anyway, they dug him up and they brought him back, and he's buried here in the cemetery adjoining the castle. And they say that since then everything has been quiet and peaceful around the place. From here, if you look around, it's a very beautiful part of the environs of the river. Now greatly overgrown, as you can see, there are bushes and shrubs and everything around the place, but when it was maintained and kept, it would have been a very prominent edifice overlooking the river. The castle itself was very, very well built and is typical of a building of that particular time. Adjoining this place is the ruins of a much later house. Now, always around castles there would have been several adjoining houses that would have been used to help out in the workings of a castle. There would have been places for livestock, there would have been places for various other people who worked on the land around the castle. But one of the areas down here, there was a fairly large house, always looking at old maps, and that's what has become known as Temple Michael House. Now, lots of people see that, but it's completely covered over in moss and mostly ivy. But there is the remains of a substantial house. The house that's there was built sometime around 1770 or 1780. That's the present house. But prior to that, there was also a dwelling. And there's a story told that it was inhabited at one time by a wig maker. And he was very, very good at his job, because apparently he used to borrow the skulls from the graveyard nearby. And he'd use those then to fashion the wigs for various people when they'd come looking for to have a wig made. A new house was built there in 1780 and was built by the third son of Grice Smith, one of the Smiths of Ballinatrae. He was the third son, and so he built a house over here, which is a fairly substantial house. He was married twice, and he had a very large family. He had about 12 or 14 children by two wives. And one of his children kept a pet crow, and his wife once wrote in a letter to her cousin that she didn't know whether it was her son, Carrie, or the crow was causing her the most trouble. Apparently both of them were very troublesome. And as a strange coincidence, I met a priest down here one day. He was Father Nugent, who was a curate in the area many, many years ago. He was later the parish priest in Lismore. But he told me that one of his daily rituals was to say his breviary, which was a number of prayers that he read out from a book. And usually priests say those at a quiet time of the day. They'll just walk around reading it, or sometimes they have it off by heart. But he said that he decided to come down here to read his breviary. And the very first time he came down, he was attacked by a crow. And he said he did it on about two or three other times, I think it was three times. And each time, he said, a bird like a raven came and attacked him, and he said he couldn't say his prayers there. But whether there was any connection with that crow and the first one I spoke about, I don't know.
Now look here, Redmond, my boy. This is a silly business. The girl will marry Quinn, mark my words. And as sure as she does, you will forget her. You're but a boy, and Quinn is willing to consider you as such.
Temple Michael Castle was also right, used Quinn? As a location in Stanley Kubrick's 1975 film, Barry Lyndon.
Many of the film's exteriors were shot in Ireland, and Ireland was standing in for England and Prussia during the Seven-Year War. In the 1750s, the father of Redmond Barry, and this was played by Ryan O'Neill, was killed in a duel over a disputed horse sale. The widow, which was played by Mary Kane, the noted Abbey actress, she devotes herself to her only son. Barry fell in love with his cousin, Nora Brady, who was played by Gay Hamilton. She seduces him. But when the well-off English captain, John Quinn, played by Leonard Rossiter, appears, Barry has no money, he's dropped. Nora and her family plan to relieve their poverty with an advantageous marriage.
Cock your pistols.
And the scene that was shot here in Temple Michael is a duel between Ryan O'Neill's character and Leonard Rossiter. And Barry refuses to accept the situation and kills Quinn in a duel.
Gentlemen.
Apparently.
Aim your pistols.
One last title card closes the film, the epilogue. It was in the reign of King George III that the aforesaid personages lived and quarrelled. Good or bad.
One.
Handsome or ugly. Rich or poor.
Two.
They are all equal now.
Three.
Is he dead?
quite dead.
The crew leave Temple Michael Castle behind and make the short journey to Molana Abbey, an Augustine monastery which was established by St. Monifede on an island called Darinish in the 6th century.
Many, many centuries later, it was co-founded for the Canons Regular of St. Augustine, and they came there towards the close of the 12th century. But the old monks prior to them were famous and well known throughout Europe. They actually, one of them, set down the actual rules and regulations for people when they needed to do penance, because they felt that it was greatly irregular. If you went to a pastor or a priest with a sin and told him your sin, he gave you penance and to do, and it could be different from one priest to another. So they made out a list, which I think ran to nearly 400 or 500 pages. They thought up all the different things that a man could do to actually cause a sin, and these then were all written out. They were quite difficult, actual things. One of the things, if you're told to lie to your neighbour, for example, you might be asked to go and stand in a river for an hour or 2 hours. If you're told two lies, it might be stand in the river and one leg with a stone on your head or something like that. They were all physical things that people were asked to do. The actual monastery itself has been in ruins for since the dissolution of the monasteries, and it's still just the ruins is what's remaining. And it forms a square around a cloister. That's the main part of it. And then the church itself is rectangular and forms elements of an older church, because what's there now is what, most of it, is what was built in the 12th century, and very, very little remains of what was built in the 6th century. It's actually lighted by 10 fine lancet windows. On the east is the chapter room, where Raymond Le Gros is said to have been buried in 1186. And there is a refectory on the south and a kitchen on the west side of the cloister. And they're both fairly large, so there must have been quite a lot of monks living there at a particular stage. There's a one side of it there, there's a two-story building, as you can see down there towards the north side of it. And this was the prior's lodging house. And then inside, in the middle of it there, there's also a statue that can be seen. It's a much, much later date. There's a statue that was built or erected in 1826 by Mary Broderick Smith, and just to commemorate St. Mullin Feeder. The abbey itself then, in the olden days, would have had a lot of land with it, all the best land here around the river, well over 1,000 acres. And the monks also had the weirs, which were built on the river, so they had an abundance of fish as well.
During the Elizabethan period, the monastery was confiscated and came into the ownership of Sir Walter Raleigh.
Raleigh sublet it to a fellow called Thomas Harriot, who would have been, I suppose, the head of his think tank, you know, his scientific group. They were basically privateers who went off and sort of got the colonies, as it were. But Harriot was quite a genius. He was kind of the Albert Einstein of his time. He brought algebra kicking and screaming into modern times, and he understood sunspot cycles, and I've heard people discussing recently that he even anticipated the effect that they'd have on radio, which Marconi didn't discover for another 200 years. So he was quite a bright spark, and he had a drawing for a telescope ahead of Galileo. But there were funny times, Elizabethan times. There were sort of all sort of conspiracies and rumours. So some people planted it in the Queen's head that they were conspiring to topple her from her crown, and they were summoned over, and quite a lot of them met an untimely end. But Spenser the poet was in there as well, and Henry Perry, who was the Earl of Northumberland, Christopher Marlowe and Edward Blunt, and John Dee, the wizard. You couldn't do without a wizard.
The next stop for the trio is a visit to Ballantrae House, one of the truly great houses on the river. The house was built in 1795 and looms large on the banks of the River Blackwater. Built on the site of a much older building, Ballantrae House is awash with stories of family conflict and scandal. Kieran Heffernan's book, Houses of the Blackwater, chronicled the house's checkered history.
The house itself came about as part, really, of the monastery. And in the 16th century, it was part of the lands of Malena Abbey. And then this was confiscated when the monasteries were being suppressed by Henry VIII. And during the settlements then, it was given to Sir Walter Raleigh. And Walter Raleigh really didn't want the huge amount of land that was granted to him in Ireland. He had no great interest in Ireland. So he sold it and sold off all his estates to the Earl of Cork in 1601. And the Earl of Cork had virtually all of the land on this side of the river, running all the way up almost as far as Fermoy. And he was a very practical man, so he had various forts and castles taken over. One of the areas, like Temple Michael, he had as a sort of station to look after his lands at that particular time. And it's said that one of the people in charge there was a man called Richard Smith. And Richard Smith, who was a soldier of fortune, really, he looked after that area for the Earl of Cork. And then in 1613, he actually married a sister of the Earl of Cork. And the Earl of Cork then leased the lands of Ballantrae and of the old abbey to him. They set about, of course, to build a house when an old Elizabethan house stood where the present house is. It was an Elizabethan manor house. But we can see none of that structure today, except on the extreme right over there, you can see just the outline of what was part of a fishing house. And they used to keep the nets and that, and that's part of the old Elizabethan structure. If you see it, you can see the way it's built, that it is indeed a very, very old building. Then one of his descendants, Grice Smith, who married Mary Broderick Mitchell, and she was an heiress and came into a lot of money. She was actually one of the Mitchells from Watergrass Hill near Cork. And when he married, he was the man who actually laid out the whole area around here as we see it today. He changed the whole face of it because he was a very busy man. He did so many things to the estate and changed it completely. And this was, he started off in 1795. And he changed the old Elizabethan manor house. He fashioned it into an 11-bay classical mansion, which is what we see there today. His architect was a man called Alexander Dean. Alexander Dean then was actually the father of a very famous architect, a man called Sir Thomas Dean. And they both worked together in Ballantrae. And all the changes then that were made at that particular time were so well done that they remained really right up until the present time. And Ballantrae remained in the Smith family until the middle of the last century, when it was inherited by a cousin, Henry Ponsonby. It was sold in 1995 to the Boissevains, who were a French family, and they then produced the house what we know today. But that was about the only thing that the Boissevains changed. Everything else remained the same. And they spent an enormous amount of money on the house and converted it. One of the major changes they made was they put a flight of steps on the front of the house and made a doorway in the centre which leads down onto the riverfront. Grice Smith himself decided that he would lay it out in a sort of Palladian style, the whole estate, as you see. He was responsible for actually planting a lot of the oak and beech trees that you can see there if you look around. Some are said to have been planted in the formation of battles, that because he was interested in old war stories, and formed in the formation of soldiers as they were arranged in battles. Whether there's any truth in that, I don't know. He joined the old ruins of the abbey because he wanted something that was picturesque and nice to look at. And he cleaned up the ruins, rebuilt actually parts of the walls so that it would be visible from the house. And then he laid out the deer park at the back of the house, and he built what we can see from here is the very fine garden. He had a walled garden and it was terraced, and that dates from the time of Grice Smith as well in 1795.
They weren't called big houses for nothing. There was a lot of interaction kind of between the people who lived in the big house and the neighbours. And if you go back, one of the Smiths' daughters, Penelope, eloped in 1836 with Charles Frederick Bourbon, Prince of Capua. He was a brother of the King of what was then the Two Sicilies. And the King wasn't best pleased about it. It was a kind of an international scandal at the time. They ran away and got married in Gretna Green. But they were banished from what passed the society with the Bourbons in Italy, and they were banished to Malta.
And they actually, in their lifetime, they got married three times in three different places, but the King still refused to accept her because she was perceived to be a commoner, not of royal blood, and this greatly upset the Bourbon dynasty on the continent. However, they went off and they lived in Malta. They had two children, and then in the end, they were, towards the end of their lives, they were sort of forgiven and they came to live in Italy. And they were given a very nice villa called the Villa of Marlia, which actually is open to the public. It's near Tuscany, and visitors go there, and on the wall there, there's the whole story about what happened to Penelope Smith and the Prince of Capua. As I said, a large house like that would have loads and loads of stories of the from the people who actually worked on the estate. Very interesting thing about the place is that Kitty Fleming was telling me that the number 13 was a particular number that they had a horror of in Ballinatrae. And once Horace Hallwright Smith bought a new car, and his father, the captain there at the time, refused to actually sit in the car because it had the number 13 on it. And by a very strange coincidence, all his family, they all died, I think five of them, died on the 13th day of the month, which is most unusual. The house then passed into new ownership in 1995, but it was an estate that had remained almost completely intact from the Middle Ages right up until that particular time.
Anybody who's read any of Molly Keane's novels, she would have written, particularly, how can I pick it as diplomatically as I can, the changing circumstances of the people living in the big houses. And she lived over an hour more, and she had a career back in the 1930s. Anybody remembers John Gielgud, Peggy Ashcroft, Margaret Rutherford? A lot of those actors and actresses would have cut their teeth in Molly's early productions on the West End stage. And like the Second World War then really kind of put the nail in her coffin. That sort of Edwardian drawing room drama went out of fashion. And Peggy Ashcroft was staying with her now more, and had taken to the bed, because Molly was like one of those, the only thing she had in common with the Reverend Mother was that she didn't seem to appreciate the strength of whiskey. So Miss Ashcroft had partaken of too much whiskey, so she was a little ill for a couple of days, and Molly gave her a child's copybook, and inside the child's copybook was the manuscript of what became Good Behaviour, and it gave her a whole new lease of life, a whole new career, shortlisted for the Booker Prize. And the reason I bring it up is so long-winded. She calls the big house in Good Behaviour Temple Alice, and of course, the castle here is Temple Michael. So all she does is just gender jump in that case.
I remember it best actually from the 1950s when I was growing up. And it was very interesting working estate at the time, because there were quite a lot of local people employed on the estate. And at that particular time, it was hunting fox hunting was the main sport, and everybody really joined in. Very often people just joined in as spectators. If people had horses, they joined in. And I remember seeing Kitty Fleming mounted on a horse. She was very daring. She got a present of a hunter from old Captain Holright Smith, and she used to hunt, but she was known for her prowess, and she was most fearless when it came to cantering and jumping. Then eventually fox hunting died out, and then the foxhounds were kept for a while after that, and they all died out, and then eventually the Holright Smiths died out. Life changed, and changed completely when the estate passed into new owners.
A family called Bouvian bought it, and the Banuslo Bouvian was one of the von Tissens of Germany. And I can remember when I started the trips, you'd see them up there. He had a fine black stallion, and she had a snow white stallion, and they'd take a little ramble up along the banks of the river there every morning for the constitutional. As time wore on anyway, decided to sell up, so they invited Channel 4 over to make a little documentary to see could they generate a bit of interest, you know, in selling the place. And at that time, people like Madonna and Robbie Williams, they looked at it, but I suppose they were afraid of people like me bringing up the paparazzi. They'd have no privacy up there. But one of the cameramen got a bit emboldened one day, and he approached Henrietta. He said, "My God, if I had this place here, I'd never leave it." So she gave him a withering look, and she says, "My dear child," she says, "the Andalusian stallions never settled." So she bought them a castle compatible with their expectations in Andalusia, in Spain.
The present owner has maintained the estate meticulously. He is actually presently restoring the walled garden, and he keeps quite a lot of pheasants for shoots.
Next week, Maeve and her crew head up the river to Deelochtan House, the seat of the Ronans, Catholic landlords who were heavily involved in the Catholic cause in the 17th century. They then travel towards Strangcally Castle, a former stronghold of the Earls of Desmond. Blackwater Life and Lodgings was produced by Noel Cronin, narrated by Mervyn Scott, researched by Angela Kearns, and edited by Sean Healy.
This programme was made with the support of the Broadcasting Authority of Ireland.